But we're going to start off with a blessing from Kelvin Ho, who wasn't here. Kelvin. Just to get us off on the right foot here.
Okay, aloha everybody. Lucas made to do a pule today to kind of get us started off. And some things came through this morning. One is we're really in a halivaa here. And lokahi or unity is really the core value that all hoi va'a paddling and sailing va'a has at its core. Hawaiian traditional belief is that the earth and nature are the body forms of the divine, that the divine communicates and informs us through signs in nature, in Ho'ailona, that man is not separate from this unity, nor is he separate from one another. Earth and nature have an innate intelligence that regulates itself, just as human bodies do. So when we puli, we do so to align ourselves with that intelligence and to remember our alignment. As humans, a path that opens to this remembrance is gratitude. And each and every one of us here, and especially our esteemed panel, have had great teachers and guides through their families and through their teachers. And we call upon their guidance to be with us now and in time to come, just as their guidance has guided us to this place in time now. We offer the same respect and a deep listening to one another tonight as our offering to the recognition of the truth that we are all in this canoe together, and that we're all children of the same sun and the same moon. The Polynesian perspective did not perceive the ocean as something that separated or isolated us from our families. It sees the ocean as what links us to and connects us to our world and to our families, and the medium upon which we voyage to connect with each other. So in this puli, we're going to humbly offer up a little time of silence and space to align ourselves with this perspective and to commit ourselves tonight to the wisdom of our ancestors. And in the course of open communication, when the appearance of differences arise, let's all find a little place to pause inside ourselves to unify again with this space, to feel the silence within us in remembrance of our unity and our purpose tonight. So let's please stand. Pulikako. Naoma kua mai kalahikia kalakau mai kahukui kahalavai. Naoma kua ia kahina kua ia kahina alo. Kia kau i kalani, owe i kalani, nunulu i kalani, kaholo i kalani. Ie ka pulapula, o ko o hana o ko ai, e malama o ko e a makou, e ulu i kalani, e ulu ka honua, e ulu ka pai aina o Hawaii, pai aina o Kauai. E ho mai ke ike, e ho mai ka ikaika, e ho mai ka akamai, e ho mai ka mapopopono, e ho mai ke ke pāpālua, e ho mai ka mana. Mahalo ke a kua, na aoma kua, mahalo kini a kua. Mahalo nunui nā kupuna. With open hearts and quiet minds, we approach to unify ourselves and to hold a place of deep listening that arises from open hearts and a willingness to really see beyond our differences, to take steps to enact change. We recognize we're all in this together. And so we offer up a silent space that each one of us, in our hearts and paths and in our faiths, commune with what we know to be divine and eternal, to recognize the blessed quality and opportunity to gather as family, as Ohana, to take steps to make change, and with a view to the horizons of what we're leaving for our children. And as our hearts are calmed by the presence of Akua's love and we feel unified with the elements and wind of this place, we offer up this prayer of gratitude and preparation in the light of spirit. Amen. Okay. Mahalo.
Thank you, Kelvin. You know, I think that definitely got us right off on the right foot. My name is Luke Evson. I'll be helping to moderate this rowdy bunch over here. Thanks for coming out to this discussion on climate change. We have an awesome panel lined up. We have Dr. Stephen Taylor back here, who will be speaking about the science of climate change. He's a professor at KCC, science of climate change, what's driving it, where we're headed globally. We have Ruby Papp, who's a Sea Grant extension agent and works at the Planning Department. She was one of the principal authors of the Sea Grant report on climate change for Kauai. So she will be speaking, I think, directly about the effects that we're going to see on Kauai over the next 50 to 100 years. We have Ben Sullivan, who's the Sustainability and Energy Coordinator for the County of Kauai. And he can speak directly about what the county is doing to mitigate and possibly adapt to climate change. Jan Tiburongate over here is the chairman of the board at KUC. He'll be speaking about renewable energy, what KUC's done to get to or approaching 50%, and maybe how they're going to get to the next 50. After they speak, we'll open the floor for question and answers. So if you guys have questions now, burning questions, try and hold on to them till they're done speaking. Then we'll open the floor for that. And then the most important part of the night, we have this board up here, a call to action, which we will talk about after they speak. So we want to get your guys' engagement, suggestions on what people are willing to do for climate change. But before I pass the mic on, I just want to add one quick thing. You know, I'm not a climate scientist, obviously, or an expert, or any qualifications to even be moderating this. But since we're in a canoe club surrounded by canoes, and since the name of our event is He Va'a He Moku, He Moku He Va'a, which means a canoe is an island, an island is a canoe. I just want to keep us rooted in that theme as we go forward tonight. You know, in 20 years of paddling, which is what I do, I coach, and in 20 years of paddling, sort of the one thing that I've learned is that success in a canoe isn't about stroke or technique or fancy training, you know, video analysis, any of that. It's trust and teamwork, you know, is the sort of the foundation for all of that. You can have everything else can be perfect. If you don't trust the people in your canoe, you don't work with them, you're not going to succeed. And, you know, if you're sitting in a boat and the guy behind you is, you know, you think in your head he's messing up or something, instantly it will turn the boat negative. You just have the thought and it ruins, limits your chances of success. And I think, you know, He Moku He Va'a, or He Va'a He Moku He Moku He Va'a, as we sort of go forward with this unprecedented problem of climate change and how we face it, you know, to sort of keep that in mind, that we're all in this together, we're all in the same boat, you know, and it's easy to blame, but trust and teamwork is going to be the only way as we can sort of make it through. So with that in mind, in the words of America's most famous revolutionary, Benjamin Franklin, he said, the waves do not rise unless the wind blows. You know, so I think the wind is blowing, and it's hot in here, which is hopefully relevant tonight. The wind is blowing, and it's up to us if we're gonna rise. So anyway, on that note, Dr. Stephen Taylor.
Thank you. Now, Mau Kau Kau. No paddlers here. Okay. Well, as complex as the climate system and global warming are, there's some things that are relatively simple about it, and I'm going to try to explain what global warming is and how we know and what the impacts are that's currently and into the future. This is Muir Glacier here in Alaska in 41, and this is 2004, and you can see the dramatic change. That's 4 miles of horizontal distance and 1,000 vertical feet. It's hard to imagine the scale of how much ice is lost there. And we can see this, and this is what we know in the scientific community here. We know that greenhouse gases warm Earth's surface. We know that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and we know that it's increasing in the atmosphere. Further, that increase, we know it's from us, and we know it's substantial. So knowing these things, what do you anticipate is going to happen is a very logical, a simple and logical prediction that comes out of that. So we maybe don't need to go through this, but I will, and is how do we know these things? How do we know that there's greenhouse gases warm the Earth? Well, that work was actually done by the famous mathematician Fourier in 1824. And it's the basis of our understanding of fields of astronomy, meteorology, oceanography, geology. Any of the introductory textbooks in those fields will talk about how Earth's atmosphere warms the planet. And astronomy, for instance, we know that Mercury, closest to the sun, gets 3 times as much sunlight at its surface than Venus. And yet, Mercury is less than half as hot. And that's because of the greenhouse effect. Do we know that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas? Certainly do. It traps heat, and this was first demonstrated through experiments in 1859, published in 61 by John Tyndall here. And that same kind of apparatus that he did can be repeated, and as it done so on YouTube by Dr. Ian Stewart on BBC. You can see where he sets up this apparatus here, where on the left side, there is an infrared camera, okay? And on the right side, there is a candle, and between it, a tube. And the infrared camera then is looking at invisible electromagnetic radiation that we cannot see, infrared radiation, what we call heat. Okay? And this is what it looks like when that camera is taking a picture of the candle. It's receiving that radiation from the candle, and if we put CO2 into the tube, what happens is it obscures the candle, so you cannot see that flame. What's happening is that even though it's visible and you can see through CO2 within the visible spectrum with our eyes, it's absorbing the infrared energy coming from the candle, so it's obscured. And some of the groundbreaking work on this was done by our military shortly after World War II, where they realized that their heat-seeking missiles weren't working quite as well as they wanted to because of this same kind of effects. Is CO2 in the atmosphere increasing? This is something we have very precise measurements from many places around the globe. Mauna Loa is shown right here. At the left, 1957, when the more precise measurements were initiated. And on the right is 2015. This is very recent data here. And you can see the increase. It's about 30% in the last 50 years. Okay. And if we go back further, this is going back 10,000 years. You can see that it's relatively flat for 10,000 of those years. And then there's a sharp, near vertical rise today. And the red line in this graph here is the measurements that I just showed you. And overlaying that is bubbles trapped in ice, which are samples of ancient atmosphere, some not so ancient, where you can compare the measurements to what we see in the ice. And we have ice that is very old, so you can go back 10,000 years and see what was the composition of the atmosphere 10,000 years ago. And we can go back much further than that with the ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland, and this is showing the last 800,000 years, and you can see rises and falls between about 200 and 250 parts per million, but there's a ramping up unprecedented ramping up of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere to 400 parts per million, and that's the modern measurements right now. Okay. Are humans the cause of this? Well, let's look at what is a fossil fuel. Fossil fuels are created from photosynthesis. Photosynthetic organisms in the ocean, for instance, algaes, they are extracting CO2 from the atmosphere to make their bodies using the energy of the sun. And they settle to the bottom. Slowly, over millions of years, they start to remove an appreciable amount of CO2 from the atmosphere. And over millions of years, this is then stored into the ground and slowly converted into more energy-dense formats, which we call fossil fuels. There are compensatory processes that return that CO2 to the atmosphere, but they're also equally slow. That's why we don't see those dramatic changes so much in CO2, such as volcanic patterns of volcanic activity, not individual volcanoes, and tectonic processes over the same time scale, hundreds of millions of years. Okay, and when we burn stuff, when we burn those fossil fuels, this is the equation that shows what's happening, and that those molecules are combined with oxygen in the air, and the product is CO2 and water vapor, along with energy. That's why we burn stuff, is for the energy there, the energy content. So the product of burning fossil fuels is undeniably CO2, and this is not something that's in dispute. So when we look at this, greenhouse gases warm Earth's surface. CO2 is a greenhouse gas that it traps heat. CO2 in the atmosphere is increasing. It's from us, and it's substantial. Therefore, what do you think, and I'm asking the audience now, what do you think is going to happen? Yeah, the planet's going to warm. Yes, right. Okay, you are now up to date on the science of the 1800s. All of these things were in published papers and scientific literature in the 1800s. The idea that humans burning fossil fuels were going to increase CO2 in the atmosphere and this was going to increase Earth's temperature was written about and talked about by scientists in the 1800s. Since then, as is the process of science, ideas are tested and retested, and these have withstood the test of time. Other ideas and explanations have not. Are temperatures increasing? Well, the thermometers say yes. So it's as simple as that, thermometers. Okay, now these thermometers are not owned by a notorious band of marauders, okay? They are world data, right? All over the world thermometers. And that raw data is compiled and analyzed and put out there by four different groups. The National Climate Data Center, NASA, Japanese Meteorological Agency, and the UK's Climate Research Unit. Okay. And all of them show essentially this same thing that's on this graph. On the far left is 1880, and on the far right is today. And what you see is an increase in global surface temperature. These are surface temperatures of the land and the ocean. Okay. And all of them show this kind of signature here. There's up and downs of weather, but the trend is undeniably upward. Okay. Now, I want you to look at that trend there. This is the surface temperature of land and ocean. That is what's on the next slide here in red at the bottom. The next slide is showing 1950 to today or 2009 about. And what you can see is that that amount of heating on the land and the atmosphere and the surface of the ocean and even the ice is very, very small in comparison to how much of the heat is actually going into the ocean. About 90% of the heat, the energy from global warming, is going into the oceans. Okay, and so you can imagine some fluctuation or change, subtle changes in the ocean circulation have a big impact on what the surface temperature reads. Okay. There's other evidence of global warming that doesn't depend on thermometers, such as the rising seas. To this point, most of the sea level rise that we have seen is not from melting of ice on land. Most of it is just what's called thermal expansion. Warmer things tend to occupy more space. As we warm the ocean, it occupies more space, therefore sea level is higher. Melting. Everything is melting right now. permafrost, glaciers, ice caps, ice sheets, sea ice, snow cover is decreasing. All of these things are measured and observed right now. Weather pattern disruption is another signature of the problem. It's hotter. There are more heat waves. You might have, there's still a thing called winter, right? Winter is still going to happen, right? Snowfall is still going to happen in places, some places there. But those record colds are far outnumbered by the record highs, right? The trend in temperature is up, even if it does snow one day in Washington, D.C. Changes in rainfall and our normal weather. Shorter winter, change in biological systems, whether it's flowering plants or migration patterns, have there's documented changes in those systems. And then drought and fire. Now, all of these things have been observed already as markers of this changing climate from global warming. Okay. So trying to keep it simple, it's not rocket science except, you know, when the military is trying to develop a heat-seeking missile, I guess it is rocket science, that greenhouse gases warm the planet and we're adding substantially more. So it's sort of a no-brainer. I mean, how could it not warm the planet, right? The predicted signature of the warming, the fingerprints, we'll say, have been observed, that it's warmer at nighttime, it's warmer in winter, and that impact is actually greater than summertime during the day. In many places, especially the polar regions there. The polar regions are warming faster than anywhere else. Okay, that doesn't sound like the sun, does it? Cooling in the stratosphere was a specific prediction for greenhouse warming, that the stratosphere would cool as the troposphere, the stratosphere is way high up, about where the jets fly, roughly, and above. And the troposphere is where all our weather and clouds are. It was predicted that the troposphere, where our weather and clouds are, was going to warm at the expense of the stratosphere, and that would cool. And we know things that drive climate naturally. And those things we understand, and those things fail to explain what we're seeing now. So there is some simplicity in a very complex issue. For instance, here is a sort of complicated figure. So I'll start you off. On the far left, we're looking at the late 1800s. Moving to the right on the x-axis is modern times. And the orange line is showing the sunspot record. Now, there is a weak and loose correlation between a minor increasing in brightness of the sun when there's more sunspots. And the blue line is the change in CO2, and the red line is change in temperature. And you can see that since about 1960 or so, which is the third to last tick on the bottom there, that the solar variability, the sunspot cycle has been going down, trending downward. At the same time, the CO2 is continuing to ramp up, and as is temperature. Those sunspots are going in the opposite direction. Okay, that's not the cause. We have another thing for longer-term climate change on the order of 100,000 years, 50,000 years, that is due to orbital changes. And these are changes in the tilt of the Earth, what part of the Earth is facing the sun at which time of year, the amount of tilt. So those change on, 50,000-year timescales there, and that leads to what we call the ice ages. So we're looking at a record on the left is 400,000 years ago, to the right is modern times, and there's a cycle at the very in the middle in red of global temperature. And you can see that there's periods when it's warm, the globe is warm, and there's periods when it's cold, when that red line goes down. We're in what's called an interglacial. It's a warm period. Here we're not in the ice age there. The red line is down near the bottom there, that's the ice ages there. Now, if you notice the top figure is CO2 concentration. There's a really close relationship between the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and the global temperature. That is from the greenhouse effect. Whether the CO2 is driving it or reinforcing this orbital change, it doesn't matter. The CO2 is integral in helping to make that temperature change happen to the degree that it's happening. And the bottom is just showing sea level. And you see that, when ice ages tend to remove a lot of water from the ocean to make that ice on land. So dramatic changes in sea level. Oh, and I should say, so this is going in the wrong direction, right? So we're already at the warm period now, right? If anything, we should be moving slowly to another ice age in about 20,000 years. As you notice, the peaks, they rise up and they kind of slowly go drop down to the right. Okay, that's our trend here, is 20,000 years from now, an ice age. And that warming, these changes happen over thousands of years. The warming we're seeing now is about 10 times faster than anything we see in the geologic record for these ice ages. So what does a few degrees mean? So we get a few degrees warmer, who cares, right? Especially if you're in Sweden. Okay. Well, the projections for IPCC, what they have, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they have these scenarios where they pull together the literature and they look at what the climate models indicate. But those outputs depend on what we do. So that's why they have these scenarios, because they can't do a forecast, because they don't know what all of us are going to do 20, 30 years from now, and that matters, right? It matters. So the mid-range projection is 5.3 degrees Fahrenheit by 2090. And the high end would be about 8.6 degrees Fahrenheit by 2090. Okay. I just want to step back to the previous figure here and look at the changes in the ice ages. The red line is going from about 1 degree above zero to minus 4 degrees centigrade. So we're looking at a 5 degrees centigrade change, right? That's about 9 degrees Fahrenheit. So the projection in for 2090, right, in some of you's lifetime, projected lifetimes here, is 8.6 degrees. Ice age, it's 9 degrees. Okay, do you see a problem? And this is happening in 100 years rather than 1,000 years. Okay, maybe you don't see the problem, but look at this figure here. This is what the world looked like during the last ice age 20,000 years ago, which is about 10 degrees Fahrenheit cooler. There was a massive ice sheet over North America. In some places over Canada, the ice was 2 miles thick. Okay, that's the kind of change that we're looking at with a 10 degrees Fahrenheit change in temperature. The ocean was 300 feet lower than it is today. Now, these things would take some time to develop, but I hope I'm giving you a sense that these are potentially very, very devastating changes to our climate system, very big changes. And the Earth will be fine. The question is, will we? Okay, a more familiar example would be El Nino. El Nino, that phenomenon there, is about a 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit change in one small region, or one region of the Central Pacific Ocean. Okay. 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit. When we talk about El Nino, we talk about a global disruption of our weather patterns. The jet stream changes, massive drought in Indonesia, flooding in Peru, changes in our hurricanes, Dot, Eva, Iniki, all of those happen and hit Kauai during El Nino years. Right? The fisheries collapsing on the west coast of the United States and South America because the ocean circulation changes and the nutrients change, and therefore the small fish and then the big fish all suffer. The mammals suffer, and that kind of thing. So this 2 to 3 degree change in one region of the globe brings about billions of dollars of damage here. This pattern is just showing, you know, December, January for the warm phase. It's different for the summertime, and it's different for the cold phase, right? So we know that our weather patterns are really sensitive to these changes, and we know, at least the model projections and what we see already, that the warming that we're going to experience is not going to be uniform. It's not like everywhere on the globe is going to raise its temperature 2 degrees uniformly. It's going to have a pattern and signature that is going to change the way our atmosphere and ocean circulates, right? And that's a problem for us because we're adapted to it being a certain way, to a certain amount of rainfall, to a certain amount of circulation. Okay. So the evidence, I'll quickly go over of some of that evidence of the warming world that I mentioned before. And this is an older figure here showing sea level rise. The red line is tide gauges from 1970. And then satellite observations overlay that in the blue line going up to about 2009. And you can see this increase in sea level rise. What I wanted to draw your attention to was the gray. The gray is the IPCC projections of sea level rise, and you'll see that it made in the early 90s. Those projections in the early 90s turned out to be underestimates, right? That the sea level actually rose at the very top end of those projections. And what I'm showing this to emphasize that what comes out of the IPCC, it's not some guy or gal, right? It's scientists all over the world is the IPCC. And they cull together all the scientific literature and summarize it, right? They're not actually doing science. They're summarizing what's out there from the scientific community by and large. And they're conservative in their estimates. Okay. Rising seas at the left, we have the Maldives. At the right, Tuvalu. We're seeing that already. The melting glaciers. Okay, I showed you one from Alaska, but it's every continent on the globe. This is Europe. But you can see glaciers melting in Asia, in Africa, and it's the vast majority of glaciers around the world are melting. This is the Kilimanjaro. Changes have been dramatic. Kilimanjaro is going to be ice-free probably in my expected lifetime. And people depend on that water. It's not going to be there. Melting permafrost. The top right is the village of Shishmaref in northern Alaska. And permafrost protected them. It's no more, and now they're subject to erosion. This village was occupied for 400 years, and they're going to be evacuating, just like Tuvalu is going to have to. So this is threatening cultures around the world as well. Disappearing Arctic sea ice. This is the Arctic here. There's an orange line. That is the 1979 to 2002 median extent of sea level. And you can see in 2007 it's dramatically less than that. It was even less than 2007 in 2010, even less than that in 2012, and this year might potentially beat that record as well. There, the key thing you want to focus on is volume of the ice, and the volume is a dramatic decline. The extent, you could have 1 year annual ice, thin ice, but the volume, and the volume is going way down. The melting ice sheets, this is Greenland. The orange is the melt area, and it's increasing. The melt area is increasing. You know, CO2 stays in the atmosphere for about 1,000 years when we put it there before nature can sort of take out that imbalance a little bit. We may be committing humanity to the complete melting of the Greenland ice sheet. It won't happen in our lifetimes unless there's some other dynamic mechanisms that destabilize the ice sheet, which is possible, but not projected. But how would we feel that we and our actions are committing to wiping off the community of Kekaha and Hanalei off the map? 20 feet of sea level rise will do that. Antarctic ice sheets collapsing. This is the Wilkins Ice Shelf in 2002. Over just a couple-day period, something the size of Kauai and Oahu combined broke off here. In the next 5 years, something the size of Maui was added to that. And there's been subsequent ice sheet collapses in Antarctica. And certainly the unusual weather, right? Okay, you know, you probably heard about the studies of our trade winds changing. You probably felt it this summer as well. One of the things we're anticipating is kind of quite an obvious one. When it gets warmer, those days that we feel the sweltering heat, the worst days that we just can't wait to pass before we get relief again, those days will be the new normal. Those will be our average days. And then those will be the cool days as we keep going into the future. Okay. And the drought, you know, think of what depends on this reservoir and this image here. It's Folsom Reservoir in California, 2011 versus 2014. It's completely dry. There's no water in the reservoir. And that was water they depended on for agriculture, for industry, for their salmon and ecosystems downstream, for hydropower they depended on, and it's bone dry. Okay. This is the fire map for Alaska in June. You cannot see the state of Alaska for all the fires that are indicated on the map here. Now, warm drought and all that kind of stuff, hey, I know it happened before. There was drought in history before. But this is the climate system on steroids. So like a baseball player that takes steroids, they're more likely to hit more home runs, right? You can't say any individual home run was the steroid home run, right? But when our climate system is hopped up on greenhouse gases, right, we're more likely to have drought, and we're more likely to have severe drought. So how solid is this science? 2001, there was a joint statement by the National Academies of Science, the most prestigious scientific societies of any nation. 16 nations were a party to this in 2001, and part of their statement said, we do not consider such doubts, the doubts that climate change wasn't human-caused and wasn't happening, we don't consider such doubts justified. That was the joint statement of 16 nations, including the U.S., the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change I mentioned in 2014, last year, the human influence on the climate system is clear. As I mentioned, these are scientists, the leading scientists in many, many, many different fields all over the world that summarize the state of the science and release a report. They essentially package it with pretty pictures, what's already out there in the literature. Every relevant scientific society, American Meteorological Society, American Physical Society, American Advancement of the Sciences, AGU, et cetera, and then the government agencies, the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, EPA, NASA, NOAA, USGS, et cetera. Now, for the DOD, the head of the U.S. Pacific Command said that climate change was the most pressing issue he faced for the future. Okay, that's those liberal wackos at the Department of Defense. So it's sound science calls for action here, and sound economics does so as well. This is the from the Stern Review. I'll finish with this slide here. It's quite a long one, but Sir Nicholas Stern was the former chief economist for the World Bank, professor of economics at London School of Economics, and the highlight is that the earlier effective action is taken, the less costly it will be. Thank you.
Do you have a slideshow? Thank you very much for that. I forgot to add at the beginning, KKCR is broadcasting live right now. So we're going to have to do a 5-minute sound check later on. Not right now, but just wanted to warn you about that. And also when we get to the question and answers, we got to sort of figure that out so we can pick up these questions live here. But also, while they're setting this up, KUC has provided some LED light bulbs. They're up at the front. If you guys have to leave early or something, make sure you grab a light bulb. There's these packs of 3 or something. And there's also these kilowatt meters, which you can plug into your wall, plug an appliance into it, and you can see how much energy you're using. These, though, are owned by somebody, so don't just grab one. Talk to Ben Sullivan here or Pat Gagan here before you leave. If you want to try one of these out, you can just see what, you know, different things are using. Do any of you guys want to go first? Maybe we can get one quick question for Dr. Taylor, if somebody's got a burning question. Yes, Felicia.
I have listeners who ask the question, they say that the ice sheet is actually widening also, like a thin, longer layer of ice. I don't actually know that myself, but do you know anything about that? Because that has been something where people say it's an example of the opposite.
Yes. So in the Arctic, there's open ocean. And so when the ocean warms, the ice melts. And that's that. Antarctica is a giant continent with lots of ice on land. So when you start to melt that ice is going out into the water as very, very cold, fresh water entering the ocean system, cooling the ocean down. So you expect to have a very thin veneer of sea ice that accompanies that melt initially. I should say that one of the things people mention is that climate has changed before. I was going to mention during the fire slide there is that, and somehow that's a reason why it couldn't be from people, which is patently ridiculous because we know fire is caused naturally, but that doesn't mean people can't cause fire as well, right? And any good fire scientist will look at the evidence and can tell you whether it was a lightning strike or someone started that fire. And that's what the climate scientists are doing. They're looking at the fingerprints and seeing this warming is from people. Thank you.
Aloha, everybody. I think maybe we're going to hold on to that question till the end, and yeah. Again, my name is Ruby Papp. I work for the UHC Grant College Program. I'm an extension agent here on the island and work extensively with Kauai County, and specifically with the planning department here, which is very interested in the subject of climate change and how to plan effectively for the changes that are inevitably to come. I am a coastal planner by background, so a lot of the information you're going to see in the next few minutes, you know, I learn from other scientists and learn how to communicate it to myself and communicate it to others, and specifically, what can we do to start adapting to these changes that are inevitable. There are also a lot of mitigating actions that need to take place in terms of reducing emissions, things like that. That is, although it's my personal interest, I ride a bike as much as possible. It's not my expertise. It's more in planning for these changes. So today I'm going to be focusing just on impacts to Hawaii. Kauai in particular, the planning department was very interested through its general plan update, which is happening now, in incorporating climate change and sea level rise considerations into planning. And it's actually now required at the state level. So this is going to be happening statewide. So as a result, Sea Grant published the Kauai Climate Change and Coastal Hazards Assessment, which is basically a synthesis of the available science and what it means basically for Kauai. There's a lot of data out there. What does it mean for Kauai and other islands, and what can we do about it? So that was basically the focus of this study. A lot of good research going on, and it's constantly changing. But so this will be pretty quick. This is a graphic from the Pacific Islands Regional Climate Assessment, which I definitely recommend if you're interested in reading more. But it illustrates just all the various impacts that you're going to expect to see. Habitat and species distribution changes, surface air rising. Obviously, we can feel it's very hot. Changes in rainfall patterns, winds and waves changes, and sea level rise, as well as base flow and streams have been decreasing, ocean chemistry changing. So all of these things have been happening and are projected to continue. Starting with sea level rise, this is the historical sea level rise rate for now Willy Willy right out here. This is what's been observed since about 1950, 1.53 millimeters per year of sea level rise. So it doesn't really seem like a lot, does it? So it's all good. But this is there's a difference. I'm here to say there's a difference between what's been observed and then what is being projected globally and for Hawaii. So here is another example. So on the left, we have historically estimates of the past where we didn't have any, you know, any way of measuring it was less than 3 inches per century of sea level rise. Then we started to be able to measure these things starting around the 20th century. You know, it was 6 inches per century, then rose to 1 foot per century by 2000. Now we're in the phase where we're actually projecting into the future, and let's see. Studies suggest that an increase of 1 meter by 2100 is a conservative planning figure for sea level rise. Could be much more. So you can see that it's just accelerating, has been accelerating, and is projected to accelerate rapidly. This is the point of this graph. This one, a little complicated, but I'll attempt to explain it. This is a survey of 90 experts in the field of sea level rise research. So this is based on 90 different studies, estimates 1 foot and 3 feet by the year 2100 for low and high emission concentration scenarios. So the low is in the blue. That's with a low greenhouse gas emission scenario, and the high is in the red. The dashed lines on the top show a NOAA assessment, which they estimated up to 6 feet of sea level rise by 2100. And these are all sort of based on various different assumptions on the amount of thermal expansion in the ocean, the amount of glacier ice melt, things like that. Those are all being projected in the science changes almost daily. But from what I've seen is the projections just keep going up and up and up. This is a graph that illustration of what we can see from impacts on the ground. I stole this from Chip Fletcher at UH. He does a lot of great talks on sea level rise. This is sea level at 3 feet in the Ha'ala area on Oahu's windward side. And just to show you what we can expect to see, new wetlands, as sea levels rise, the water table rises as well. So you get to see more wetlands, more flooding and drainage issues, more coastal erosion, saltwater intrusion into our water supplies, drainage issues as we have more and more flooding inland and from the ocean. Our road access, as you know here, a lot of our roads are right along the coastline. It's our primary access that will be threatened. Just basic wave overtopping, in addition to still water flooding. Perhaps our evacuation routes and shelters might need to be reevaluated. This is actually a situation that was happening in this town. Isolated communities, and then also perhaps add to that flash flooding. And this is at a 3-foot scenario, which is projected as a conservative planning target for the year 2100. This is a map that we did based on data from for Hanalei that shows a potential 6-foot scenario, which is at the higher end of the extreme. And that all can be found in this assessment, which is actually online on the Sea Grant website. And it's being used right now to inform the general plan update that's happening. You've probably heard in the news and in various outreach events that the planning department is updating the general plan and incorporating this information into it. So just getting into some of the hazards that I went over, coastal erosion. This is something that we've been dealing with for a long time on Kauai. And historically, according to the USGS National Assessment of Shoreline Change, 71% of Kauai's beaches have been eroding during the last century. So that's historical data based on observations from aerial photographs. So we know that 71% of beaches are in this erosional state generally. We also know that sea level rise exacerbates erosion. So this is that same graph I showed you of Now Willy Willy, sea level rise. On the right is an erosion rate map, which we have for all the sandy beaches. That studies have been done that correlate the historical rate of sea level rise to historical erosion patterns. So we know that that's happening historically. We also know through a new study that just came out that with the predicted acceleration in sea level rise, because this is just a historical rate, but with the acceleration, using the various scenarios, 1 foot, 3 feet, 6 feet, you could get a doubling of erosion rates, which means, dramatically different shoreline positions as the shoreline marches inland and threatens our infrastructure and our communities. We're also going to see increased tropical storms, hurricanes, and the impact from those storms could be much greater due to the rise in the sea level and the storm surge impacts. And this is just something I think is very apropos for today. This is it's getting hot. I can feel it right now. It's hot summer. I mean, we know we're in El Nino, but it's, as Steve mentioned, it's just going to keep getting worse. Well, a study that was done for Hawaii on the projected timing of a climate departure. in Hawaii. And this is done by Camilo Mora at the University of Hawaii. Basically, the rate of warming of the air temperature in Hawaii has quadrupled in the last 40 years. That's the rate, not the temperature. The rate of change has quadrupled to over 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. The graph is the projected timing of the climate departure, so meaning when average temperature will exceed the historical bounds, which are in gray. So that's the historical temperature changes in gray since before 1900. By the year 2023, we're going to be seeing unprecedented temperatures based on a business-as-usual scenario or a high greenhouse gas emissions scenario. And then that change that reduces to the year 2050 if we start getting our act together and reducing those emissions a little more. But we're going to see it's going to be a lot harder in my lifetime and most of our lifetimes. I also wanted to touch a bit on rainfall. It's a little complicated. It's not something that we focused on in our study, but have been personally reading a lot about it and trying to write about it. But there's also a great publication, really easy to read, Climate Change Impacts in Hawaii, that you can get online, done by Sea Grant and various other partners. But basically, as Steve mentioned, there's a decrease in the northeasterly trade winds, and that affects rain. We have seen a 30-year marked decline in rainfall and a 70-year stream flow declines in those rates. And just basically that more drought and flash flooding is predicted. The general rule of thumb is that dry areas are going to get drier, wet areas are going to get wetter. But there is the issue of downscaling, the complicating issue of downscaling global climate models to a small island, Kauai, or just the island chains, and kind of figuring out what that means for each side of the island, you know, how much rain we're going to get here and there. So I would say definitely stay tuned to the science on that. But the trends are that as such here. Yeah, so I just, you know, I didn't want to, I only had 10 minutes to speak today. There's a lot of what I do is try to focus on how can we plan, how can we adapt to these things. That's what this study was focused on, basically on an island-wide level. There's lots we can do individually as well, and I think we're going to kind of get to that. But the idea is we've got to improve our resilience and preparedness to these hazards that we're already dealing with today, but they're going to be getting increasingly worse. So thank you for your time. Questions?
You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is your community radio station.
Thank you, Ruby. KKCR has to do a three-minute, somewhere on there, sound check right now. So maybe, again, we got one time. This isn't going to be on the air, but time for one.
This KKCR program is supported in part by Afer Feinberg Gallery, E-Waste Recycling, this part of KKCO program is supported in part by Kalaheo Chiropractic, Kamoa Ukulele, and the Healthy Hut.
Kalaheo Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, postural training, cold laser therapy, and spinal decompression. Open Monday through Friday, now a second location in Kapa'a, 822-0711, or Southside Center at 332-5580, or online at kalaheochiropractic.com.
Kamoa Ukulele Company, dedicated to building high-quality bell-tone instruments, built with one player at a time philosophy, from student models up to custom masterpieces. Kamoa Ukulele Company, a family-owned business, supports KKCR, 652-9999 or online at kamoaukulelecompany.com.
Healthy Hut Market and Cafe, now right off the highway in the old school building in Kilauea. Organic and natural groceries, produce, raw foods, beer and wine, an expansive organic salad bar, fresh hot meals, smoothies, juices and coffees, and locally made products. Healthy Hut, a family-owned business, supports KKCR.
Mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. We're doing a live broadcast right now from the Canoe Club in at Kalapaki Beach. Also, a couple quick announcements about some events coming up. This is a Tahitian festival.
Heiva is a celebration of Tahitian culture. The 14th annual Heiva I Kauai Yorana Tahiti will be held at Kapa'a Beach Park on August 1st and 2nd. Gates open at 9 a.m., opening ceremony at 9:30. 2 days of dance and drumming competitions with Polynesian artists, cultural demonstrations, jewelry and accessories direct from Tahiti, silent auction and island foods. A special guest Tahitian dance group from Honolulu, Te Wai Ura Nui, will present traditional Otea and modern Aparima and Ahupurotu dances, sponsored by HTA, wow. County of Kauai and Geico, 822-9447 or heivaikauai.com.
That's this weekend, the Tahitian Festival, and also coming up is the Music and Mango Fest.
Waipa Foundation presents the 3rd Annual Music and Mango Festival Sunday, August 9th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Halulu Fish Pond, located a half mile past Tanalei Town. Live music, hands-on activities, food demos, local artisans and crafts, a water slide and contests including Best Mango Dish and Biggest Mango. This fundraiser for the Waipaa Foundation is a special opportunity to enjoy a relaxing day in the Ahupua'a. WaipaaFoundation.org or 826-9969.
All right, we're going back live to our live broadcast.
But much more sort of with your guys' engagement instead of, you know, hearing from them. So, one, those papers right there, you can fill out a suggestion, put it in the box. Make sure you write your name on it and make sure your contact information, make sure you signed in so we can sort of have a way to contact you. You good? Okay, I will explain that board after Ben speaks then, or after Ben and Jan speak.
Hello. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. Appreciate the opportunity to address you tonight. My name is Ben Sullivan. I'm the Energy and Sustainability Coordinator for the County of Kauai. I work for Mayor Bernard Carvalho. I'm really happy to be here. It's a tough act to follow. There's a lot of science, a lot of data that we just got presented that is really not easy to take in, even if we know it. And I think that's kind of the process that we're in. So, all my intention is, as far as communicating with you guys tonight, is to just give you a little bit about what the county is doing, primarily in terms of the county as an organization. We can talk also a little bit about what the county is doing as government and influencing policy on the broader island perspective. But I think really what I'd like to do is get through a discussion quickly just to give enough to kind of feed the mill so that when we break and everybody starts talking towards the end of the meeting, there's something to talk about. The first thing I will say is that a couple of years ago, I was really happy that Mayor Bernard Carvalho set a very aggressive goal for the county. And when I say the county of Kauai, I'm speaking of the organization, not about countywide, because obviously we can influence policy and everything countywide, but that ultimately comes down to everyone acting together. What we have very direct control over is our own use of fossil fuels. And so the mayor set a goal of 80% reduction in county-generated emissions by 2023, which is going to take us a tremendous amount of work, some luck, and a lot of things falling into place, but it's something we can achieve. And we feel like it's important to have that aggressive goal, both to be leading and also to be learning along with all of you as far as mitigating our emissions. Before I go on into the details of that kind of stuff, I want to comment on what Luke said about, you know, the analogies to the canoe, and just reflect on how important that is. You know, I mean, here we are in this process, and it is so easy. And, you know, this is my job, is to take on energy challenges and try to reduce energy use and move towards renewable energy every day. It is so easy to lose sight, you know, in light of what we just saw, of the importance of mitigation. You know, we're this tiny island, and what is it going to matter, and all that kind of stuff. But I would posit to you, and hopefully you feel the same way, that it's exactly the opposite. You know, it's everyone in the canoe, and it's ultimately believing that everyone else is taking action to benefit the whole. That is really the only way we're going to get there. The minute you look back and you criticize your fellow paddler, you lose sight of what you're doing yourself. So the magic happens when we do have that faith. And so I'm going to try to maintain that, as difficult as it is. So back to the county and our specific goals: 80% reduction in emissions by 2023. I will do this in a really rough fashion, just so you get an idea of what we're talking about. Our biggest uses of fossil fuel, which is obviously our biggest generation of greenhouse gases, are in ground transportation and electricity. On the ground transportation side, what we see as our big pieces in terms of mitigating our climate emissions are two. One is a potential switch over to renewable natural gas. And this is, you know, short term, next 20 years kind of thing. But the project would happen sooner than that. Specific to our bus fleet, but also to our other heavy vehicles, the landfill out in Kekaha emits about the equivalent of about 800,000 gallons of diesel fuel every year into the atmosphere. That diesel, that methane gas is a potent greenhouse gas, but it is also a potential source of fuel. So luckily, thank you to the council members who are here and to others who are involved, the county did just recently fund what's called the gas collection system out there. So we would be capturing that gas. And within a year or two, we're going to get into the very nitty-gritty of the quality and quantity of that gas and determine if we can, in fact, follow what our initial feasibility studies have told us and use it in our vehicle fleet. So we feel like this is a very positive way to reduce our emissions. We're hopeful for the project, but there's a lot of details that have to be filled in. Another project on the or another emphasis on the fleet side is really just efficiency. So we have a good amount of fuel that's being used on the heavy vehicle side, but obviously we have a pretty significant light vehicle fuel fleet as well. Uses a lot of gasoline. And so what we have been doing already and what the county has done a great job of is, you know, obviously moving to hybrids. You see a lot of county Priuses out there. But that effort is going to really be redoubled in that we are looking at, you know, how far can we push electric vehicles? What percentage of the fleet can we move to electrics? And then how much further can we push moving to higher efficiency vehicles? We've done some recent piloting of motor pools. That's really given us some great data as far as how we use our vehicles. That really is going to enable some of that transition. Again, it's not going to be easy. Right now, we're not buying any new vehicles at all because, you know, the tightness of budgets and whatnot. But in future years, when it comes time to buy more vehicles, we're really going to lean towards the most efficient vehicles we can get. Those two measures I just mentioned, one, the renewable natural gas, and two, the fleet efficiency, are really key on the vehicle fuel side to reaching our 80% goal. Now, on the electricity side, we've got some very ambitious goals, but also we have important partnerships that get us there. So to achieve our 80%, basically the rough outline is this. We have a goal of reducing our energy consumption by 30% by 2023. And that's compared to a 2012 baseline. I'm happy to report that this is the first year we've seen substantial progress on that. We actually have about a 5% reduction in electricity use outside of the utilities. So basically all of our buildings and whatnot are showing a substantial electricity use reduction from last year. And we have projects in the pipeline that are going to really continue that trend, and we're very positive about that in terms of seeing that progress continue. One that you may be aware of is the conversion of the streetlights to LED, which we owe a great debt to KIUC for helping us with. Another is really the kind of more mundane stuff on a facility level where we're replacing chillers with the most efficient chillers we can get so that, you know, yes, we need air conditioning in these big office buildings, but we can do it more efficiently. Same thing with, you know, kind of wonky things like building control systems, which I won't bore you with the details, but ultimately they lead to substantial savings on the electricity usage side. The last, a second component of reducing our electricity use, or I should say our electricity sector emissions, is, you know, after we've done as much as we can in terms of efficiency, what we're strategizing about is how we can move our electricity load to align with renewable sources. And so what that means is that obviously KIUC is doing a tremendous job of generating electricity from renewable energy sources, and Jan's going to talk about that shortly. But what we want to do as actually the biggest or one of the biggest customers of the county is we want to learn how to move our loads such that to the extent possible we're using electricity when it's cleanest. So, you know, the middle of the day, everyone is very well aware of all the progress that's been made with photovoltaics. I would propose to you that the magic of photovoltaics is not having the system on your roof, but having the load that's occurring when the sun is shining. Because as a co-op, we know we can do really well with PV. We can put in a ton of it. But that limit is based on how much demand there is. And so the county is looking at ways, how can we actually shift our demand more to the middle of the day? And we're just at the very early stages of that. We're learning the potential of that. Water, wastewater, big chiller plants, things like that. But it's something we need to become more literate at. So data systems and understanding our loads and then understanding how we can shift those loads is key. The third way, and you might be thinking, hey, 30% and a little bit of moving loads around doesn't get you 80. Well, the third thing is really relying on a partner, and that is We're relying for that 80% goal on the fact that KUC has a goal of 50% renewable energy by 2023. And not only are we relying on it, but we are very much in partnership with them, and we look for every opportunity to collaborate and assist. And we understand the value and the importance of what the cooperative is doing for our community. And so we actually have a very specific memorandum of understanding that was signed a couple of years ago. And Mayor and David Bissell, who works for Jana and the rest of his board members over there, get together on a regular basis and talk about how, you know, what things we can do to help each other along and to help make progress for the benefit of everyone here in the room. What else are we doing, and what else can I appraise you of? I'm not sure if I want to spend a lot more time. We had a lot of climate science presented. Jan's got some good ideas, so I think I'm going to leave it at that. With that, Jan ten Bruggen, Kate, I don't know. Luke, do you want to? Okay, I'll just hand it over. Thank you.
Thank you. And we shouldn't go any further. First, I want to thank Apollo for this session. I want to make a note that as KIUC is our community's electric co-op, we have two former KIUC directors in the room, Stu Burley over here and Ben Sullivan, and Pat Gagan and I currently serve on the board. I don't speak as well off the cuff as my three predecessors did, so I'm going to sit down and read most of this. I think it's interesting that we're having this session on a day. Those of you who get Star Advertiser news alerts see that we've got a hurricane sitting out there about 800 miles right now. Hurricanes, I was told by some of the scientists that I used to interview when I was a young reporter, are heat engines. And I saw a quote just this morning from a University of Arizona professor named Gary McPherson, who said civilization is a heat engine. I'm looking at Joanne. I also want to note that Joanne helped start the co-op and played an important role. So we, our community, and we, our electric utility, are one of the biggest producers of carbon dioxide on our island. That and everybody's car are the two big ones, I think. KIUC's experience with moving off of oil and onto renewables is kind of an alternate universe version of if you build it, they will come. In our case, even if you don't know how it's going to happen, you plan for it, you believe in it, you commit resources, and you take a leap of faith that it'll happen. Kauai 30 years ago, as many of you remember, got half of its power from renewables, mostly bagasse, but also a little plantation hydropower. By the late 2000s, sugar was gone, and we had dropped to below 10% renewable. When I was first elected to the KIUC board 6 years ago, we were at 92% oil. The state required us to get back to 40% renewables by 2030, with another 30% from efficiency, and also to reach 1990 levels of greenhouse gas emissions by 2020. It was not at all clear how that could be accomplished. Our strategic plan said we would beat the state's deadlines, but we didn't know how. KIUC began by retransforming itself as an organization. We used the skills of our existing staff and brought in help where we needed it. We put out a request for proposals and received many interesting projects with different technologies. Some were quite innovative. Many were untested. Some required new technological leaps, and almost all of them were way too expensive. One of those survived with some close shaves, and it was the Green Energy Team's wood-fired plant near the tree tunnel. And I'll note that Eric Knudsen, one of the principals of that effort, is sitting in the room. In the meantime, dropping pricing for solar power and tax incentives made that a viable energy source. Low-cost solar and tax incentives were available to utilities everywhere, but at KIUC, we jumped in with both feet. And we soon led the state in solar technology. When we signed up Kurt Bosshard's 1-megawatt plant in Kapaa in 2011, it was the biggest in the state. In 2012, when we signed a power purchase agreement for ANB's 6-megawatt plant at Port Allen, it became the biggest in the state. When we turned on KIUC's 12-megawatt Koloa plant a year ago, it was the state's biggest, and our Anahola 12-megawatt array scheduled to be turned on later this year. will be marginally bigger than Kolowa and once again will be the biggest in the state. We're a nonprofit. We can't benefit from a lot of tax incentives, but we adapted a system used elsewhere for wind projects and created for-profit subsidiaries that could take and use tax credits that helped drive our members' electric bills down. Top to bottom, KIUC has an excellent creative staff that's making a difference for our members and for the planet, and that was just one example of one of the ways we did it. KIUC, by the end of this year, will have more solar power per resident than any utility in the country. These innovations are not without risk. These innovations are not without risk. Our entire organization recognized that we were treading new ground, and our entire organization stepped up. Nobody in the country had tried bringing as much intermittent renewable energy onto a grid as we have. And we did it while maintaining, in most years, the best reliability of any electric utility in the state. An additional benefit was that all those solar power plants produced power priced below the cost of oil-fired power at the time we made each deal. That was not the case for some of the solar plants done elsewhere in the state. We were changing the culture at every turn. Still, as everyone knows, we're still mostly burning oil for our nighttime power. We needed to tackle that problem. We hired nationally known consultants to look at the island's hydroelectric potential. They studied every major river and ditch system. The opportunities were limited, but our identification of a potential resource on Gay and Robinson land led that company to proceed with it, and we have signed a power purchase agreement with them, and they're active in permitting. We looked at storage options. Last year, we reviewed a pile of battery technologies. Some didn't meet our needs, and all of them were so expensive that they would have driven member power bills up, so we didn't go down that path. However, our hydropower investigation did suggest that there might be a potential for an old storage technology called pumped hydro. It's a water battery. In daylight, when there's excess solar power, we use that power to pump water uphill. And at night, when we would otherwise be burning oil, we would let the same water run down through a hydroelectric plant and effectively shift cheap solar power into the nighttime hours. Our consultants identified several locations on the west side. We're currently conducting engineering studies on two of them. The price seems right. And once the development costs are paid off, the price to our grandchildren will be downright cheap. It's a legacy plant. If built, it'll be providing cheap energy storage for a century. So how are we doing on those renewable energy goals? We expect to be just short of 40% renewable powered by the end of this year. That's five times more than we were doing 6 years ago. And it's 14 years ahead of the state mandate of 40% by 2030. That pumps... Thank you. That pumped storage plant with some more solar could get us to 50% renewable in plenty of time to beat both our own strategic plan goal of 50% by 2023. We expect, other things being equal, to reach the 1990 greenhouse gas emission levels in 2018. Kauai Electric in 1990 released 247,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. At our peak in 2007, we reached 350,000 tons. Last year, we were back down to 275 and dropping. This year, the legislature upped the ante. They want us to get to 100% renewable by 2045. And potentially, that's 100% of a much bigger load if the power grid is expected to charge a massive new fleet of electric vehicles. We're back in the situation we were 8 years ago, committed to doing it, not really sure how it happens. KIUC's engineering team has more experience with putting renewable power onto the grid than engineers at almost any electric utility in the world. We get national awards for our solar work. Our engineers tell me that 100% renewable is technically feasible right now, but remarkably expensive. Our commitment, as it was 6 years ago, is to lower electric pricing, not increase it. To get there cost-effectively, we need new renewable generation advances, improved and cheaper battery technology, more conservation and efficiency. Globally, more investment is being made in these areas than ever before, and we anticipate the solutions will present themselves. At our member-owned cooperative, we believe it's possible. We're planning for it. We fully expect we can get there. But as before, we're not yet sure how. And that's it. Thank you.
Stay up here, Jen. And if you guys want to come up. Thank you for that. So we're going to do, we're going to try and do about 15 minutes of question and answer. And we don't want it to go on too long because we do want to get to that board up there, which we'll explain after. And also, you know, we do have plenty of drinks and food back there. It is a zero waste event, so there's limited cups. And there's recycling for it all back there. But and just for the people on the radio listening, I want to say that we got about probably about 80 people in here or so, and hopefully maybe millions listening on the radio. We'll open this for questions, and we're going to try and use these two mics. If it works, if you're not too far away, I'll pass you this mic, speak into the mic, and then we'll pass this mic to whoever you're asking a question of.
The question to me is, I have heard nothing about reducing human population. Has that occurred in any of your studies? It seems from reading the birth announcements, we're not decreasing, we are increasing. And each one of those births is going to represent an adult like me using far more of everything in the future, very near future.
Before passing on to one of them, I want to say one thing on that question, and I know I'm not qualified to answer these, but I think a big takeaway for me has been we're having all of this warming is occurring with our current population. You know, unless there's a massive Holocaust somewhere, we're not reducing our current population. You know, so this is happening. We have to work with what we have, as well as work on, you know, obviously not reproducing so much, but we got 7.5 billion people. They're not going anywhere.
I think we actually rehearsed this question prior to the panel. And I believe, unfortunately, I was the one who was anointed to try to respond. And Marge, I think we guessed it might be you that asked it. So I appreciate your tenacity and certainly respect the perspective, and it is a critical one. I don't have an answer. You know, obviously, I hope you weren't expecting one. The thing I think that you have to retort with as a matter of course is really to reflect on the fact that we as Americans use grossly more resources than anyone else on the planet. So it's easy to blame it on population and say, look how many people are in China or wherever else in India. But we're the ones who started this mess, and we're the ones who need to lead and get out of it. So yes, that's important, but I don't have a response other than that.
Yeah, agreed. Population is increasing. For me, I prefer to focus on things I can control, and that's looking at our consumption, looking at how we can plan for this, and it's a good question, but...
An old and serious problem, I don't have a solution, but there's an important point to make, and that is population is dramatically growing in countries where the people don't actually emit a lot of greenhouse gases. The countries that emit a lot of them per person are not growing substantially right now. That's an important caveat to that, that we, you know, tend to flock say, oh, well, it's those other people over there who are the problem. But no, it's us. It's U.S. citizens are more responsible for climate change than any other citizen in the whole world. And I hear comments that China's the cause and all that. China just now caught up to emitting as much as our country does, even though they have three times the population of our country. And historically, no one's close to us, historically.
And I don't have a whole lot to add other than it's hard to miss the lemming analogy.
Let me also add that since we only got 15 minutes, that we'll keep the questions as brief as we can.
This is going to be really brief. I understand Tesla Motors has come out with a battery storage that's really inexpensive that everybody can use in their houses. Have we looked at that as a possibility for storage for KIUC?
I can't speak for the utility, but I mean I've paid attention to that clearly. The Tesla battery, as I understand it, is not designed as a bulk storage device. And in fact, Elon Musk, when he announced it, made the point that it's that's not what it's for. And there is no battery technology today that, in the work that I've done, is at a price that makes home storage reasonable. Home storage is possible. Lots of folks living off the grid. It's an expensive alternative currently. I suspect with the amount of money that's being spent on battery technology right now that we're going to get there and get there soon. And that's going to be an upheaval for the utility industry. There's no question.
Yeah, my question is for the KIUC aspect, and it regards the biomass burning trees. Now, I have a problem with it because when the trees are grown like that, They prevent natural filtration, percolation of our watershed. One. Two, it's pre-coal, and I know you guys burn them at high heat furnace, but we have so much green waste production. I own a small lot, and I always go into the rubbish dump. And I know we don't have space for our refuge area. And on top of that, we already know that methane gas is produced in these anaerobic conditions. Why are we growing trees to burn when we have so much green waste that we could burn in that aspect of your energy production?
He's passing it to me because as a representative for the county, I can say that we're very interested in finding offtakes for our amount of green waste. It's a very challenging proposition. What you have at the Green Energy Farm, and Eric Knutson can speak to this, is a very exacting piece of engineering that requires a very consistent feedstock. And, you know, when you spend $90 million, you need to know exactly how much, exactly how it's going to work, and you've got to have it all lined out. With the amount of green waste that we have is not really commensurate with that. It's substantially less than what is required to run that plant. So I can assure you that there's an understanding and people are interested in using it, and that may happen down the road, but at this point, we haven't been able to figure out exactly how to unlock it. There's numerous challenges associated with it.
We'll go one, two, three. Real quick, it was actually my question is not, it's kind of about the burning of waste, but not the green waste. It was more the proposed waste burning on the west side, the solid waste turning into jet fuel. How does that complement or not complement the issue at hand?
So the best answer I can give you right now is that there's exploration into a whole lot of different possibilities for how to manage solid waste. It is a huge problem for the county, economically, environmentally, as you're well aware, and really nothing is off the table at this point. That's the best answer I can provide you. So it's substantially less impactful than landfilling as far as climate change goes? Potentially. I mean, you know, ideally if we could get this to a zero-waste solution that really brought us there, that would be better. It's you know, it's a very complicated question to try to respond to.
Hi. In answer to the first question, which I thought was kind of ridiculous. I mean, really, do you want to reduce the birth rate? Our problem is not reducing our birth rate. A solution to the problem is exactly what Ben had mentioned. And this guy, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. And Jen. Okay, so anyway, they repeatedly said that it's just America and the way we use up our resources, and we just use it up just, you know, irresponsibly. And so that's why, you know, like even China, okay, now they're admitting, but it's not them. They're not irresponsibly using their resources because of the population, you know. So when you think about it per capita, it's just Americans and their very wasteless kind of lifestyle. And that's what it is. So if we just control our resources and we do everything we can in the way of renewable sources or whatever, you know, we're fine. We're going to be fine.
And do you have a question?
I'll take care of the birth rate. I wondered, you know, when this lady had talked about, you're working for the county, right? Okay, it was kind of weird because you said you're working for the county and you have wonderful facts about the shoreline and the erosion, but then Joanne mentioned that they just set it up, you know, the setbacks and everything. Okay, great that they said 20 feet away from the shoreline, but the thing is, it almost sounds like you have a wealth of information working for the county. Joanne is working for the county as a council member, and it's like she didn't realize that you're working on the same in the same direction and you have facts. So I'm wondering, what's going on? Don't you guys collaborate?
No, I don't think that's accurate. We actually worked very closely together on the shoreline setback ordinance, and the ordinance is based on the best available science that we have now. And I was presenting to you some new science that is not ready for planning purposes yet. Simple as that. I mean, the county is using the best available science it has, which is based on erosion rates, historical erosion rates. There are new studies now trying to fill the gaps all the time. What are we going to do about sea level rise impacts? And we need to know how that's going to impact erosion, how it's going to impact wave inundation, and all these factors that we don't know exactly yet how to plan for. And so that's what researchers are starting to do now. But it's at the beginning stages. It's not ready for law for changing our ordinances yet, because we don't, it's just not at that resolution. So, but we definitely collaborated on the shoreline setback for 3 years, and I think it's the best that it can be at this point, and we'll have to reevaluate.
My question is the scientific side of the panel. Recently, the geography department at UH did a study that was nationally recognized with regards to temperature trends and ocean pH, for instance, and the variables and the rate of change and the trend. And they said that they had done a very conservative analysis, and that in their particular choice of conservative interpretation of the data, they came up with 2043 or 46 as being the first year that there would be an actual geographic position that would be uninhabitable. And it was on the equator and the Indonesian islands. And I'm wondering what type of certainty and percentage of accuracy you could say with regards to 2080, 2040, 2020, 10 years from now? Could 10 years from now be a significant impact with regards to temperature range?
Joanna, you're going to be next, but if you can come up for it after this.
I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I think I put a slide up that said 2023 was going to, for Hawaii, was going to be a departure from the historical norm. So it's going to be a lot hotter weather, and I don't have the answer to your question about 10 years from now. I mean, I don't know.
There's in the IPCC report, there's a very broad range of scenarios that encompass the actions of people, and I think they've covered pretty well the very best we could hope for at the low end, and then some of the worst more anticipated things based on processes that we know and understand today right now. As I mentioned, the IPCC projections of sea level rise were low, and that was because they didn't account for some processes that are happening. So, unfortunately, the unknowns and the uncertainty is on the side of bad things, and that's about all I can say about that.
I have three things that I believe is also contributors to heat. One of them is the sun is called a constant. And on your graph, you notice it was pretty much so level. And the second one is a variable. It's volcanic activity, which produces heat around the world. And it's more now. And the third variable, heat, would be all temperature. Everything creates heat, light, cars, campfires. And this is a cumulative effect of thousands of years. It's not just in this industrial area time, you know. It's from thousands of years. It's cumulative. It's continued to just grow and grow. So every fire-producing thing, so ovens and whatever you want to, all that man, campfires and everything, what do you think of that? These things, right?
I forgot the first one.
What was
the
one?
Yeah, well, the solar intensity is marginally going down. So at the same time, the temperature is increasing. So I think we feel pretty confident for decades. We feel pretty confident it's not the sun for the current warming. Volcanic eruptions, if they're big enough eruptions, they release particles high in the atmosphere, which cool the planet, and that for a couple years before they rain out, about 2 years. And that's something we see in the climate system quite often happening. And the third thing, the... you know, we all know that the old-style light bulbs we have in our houses, you have those on, you turn the oven on, your house gets hot. So I don't blame people for having that association, but compared to the warming from the greenhouse gases, that's really a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's just a much more massive amount of heating from the greenhouse gases.
And we've got enough time for probably three or so more questions. So we'll keep them brief, and I see you guys...
Question for you, Ben. You said you're going to use natural gas in the county. What are you going to use it for, and where is that gas coming from? Is it coming from fracking?
I'm sorry. That's an important clarification. What we intend to use is methane from the Kekaha landfill. So that is what is termed renewable natural gas. That methane would otherwise be released into the atmosphere. At this point, there's no plan within the county to use compressed natural gas or mainland-based natural gas. You know, that's more of a question for KIUC.
I'm going to have to let some other people. There was some. And you wanted also.
The best idea that I can come up with for incentivizing change is to have a pay-to-pollute type of situation to restructure the tax structure to basically incentivize people to change, to tax gasoline more and so on. It seems like there's so much talk about doing things, but if it costs too much to not do it, if it costs more to not do it. But I think we have to not be afraid of things costing more, because money really rules the world in a lot of ways, and to really enact change, I think, to restructure the tax system and put that incentive in is a good idea. I'm wondering what you think about that.
Sure. There's a lot of talk, a lot more talk than there was previously about carbon tax and the potential for a carbon tax. Obviously, that's most likely implemented at a national level, and certainly would have, you know, impacts that would be positive to the effects we're talking about. So it's on the table, and I think that's heartening to see. You'll notice one of the suggestions up on the board up there is related to kind of global discussions, and which that really falls into national global discussions. As you're probably aware, there's the big talks in Paris coming up in December, and so those are some of the kind of things that would be on the table. Something else that's happening more and more lately that I think is, it's not a tax, but it's really interesting, is you're seeing, you know, some very substantial commitments on the part of large corporations to reduce their emissions. This is only in the last, you know, 6 months that I've noticed it. It's been going on for a while, but it's really accelerating. And it's really positive. I mean, imagine if we had that, you know, on a community scale. If you know, here's county and KIUC, and what about some of the big hotels all coming out publicly and saying, this is what we're going to do with our emissions. Pretty soon you get there, you know, with that cumulative effect. So I think that's another one that we should be thinking about. That's a, kind of a positive reinforcing loop, which is to say publicly, this is what we're committed to doing as part of a community that has to all do it.
Okay, we got two more questions since you're in the back raising your hand. So we're going to go with you and then you. But When we're finished with this, you know, we wanted to finish early enough so that everybody could hang out and talk, you know, and eat food and do the suggestion board, which we'll talk about in a second. So there'll be plenty of time to talk to these guys directly and ask questions. So it'll be.
All right. This is in reference to the like landfill mining, as I kind of like to call it, but and getting the biogas. So I was told that for a period of time after we cap it, that we're going to be flaring it. Is that true?
A lot of interest in the landfill gas. By nature, you would have to flare a percentage of it. We're going to try to minimize the flaring and maximize utilization, but ultimately you do actually have to have a flare because you're always going to have waste gas as a byproduct, and so you need to flare a portion of the gas. Yes.
So there is a lag time where we're just flaring and not collecting? And if so, I'm curious why, because it seems like biogas mining and landfill mining is pretty common technology that's been going on for a really long time.
So I'm not sure that I agree with you on landfill mining. I think it's actually fairly new, and I think our Department of Health would probably have some very significant concerns about exactly how that might work, but certainly it could come about. I'm not aware. Landfill gas capture is absolutely something that's critical. So what I mentioned in my brief talk was that we have, in fact, the county has, in fact, funded a substantial investment in a gas control and collection system out at the landfill, and so that's being constructed now. That is where the flare, you know, the flare is the end of pipe for that system. So is there another component of the question I missed? Okay. That, great question. In order to finance the project, you need two pieces of data that are really critical. One is you need to know exactly how much gas you have, and two, you need to know what the quality of that gas is and what the contaminants are. In order to get that data without just estimates, you've got to have the capture system in place. And so there is a lag, and that's the reason for it.
You want to? And Rob, did you have a question? Mm-hmm.
Hi, thank you for being here. So I just kind of had like a nuts and bolts kind of like localized level question. Actually, a good friend of mine made this proposal to me in us just talking about what we can do. And this might sound like maybe we're passing the buck down to the tourists, but we had this idea of creating like a limitation or like a moratorium, I guess, on rental cars, because we are, of course, a finite amount of space, and I don't mean to, again, push the problem onto the tourists, because we ourselves as residents have to incorporate some lifestyle changes ourselves, but as an idea, on a very basic level, what do you, you know, like, I don't really understand how much control we could have over that kind of commercialized or that industry, but what do you all think of that kind of way to limit like the emissions of carbon?
You know, I would love to defer to some of our elected representatives in the room because, but I would suggest you have a conversation with them because that is the process, is really engaging your elected representatives and figuring out what's possible, recognizing that tourism is a critical part of our economy. You know, we can't just overnight say, hey, let's cut off the tourists, as I think you recognize in your comment. So, you know, do we need all the ideas on the table? I think based on what we saw today, yeah, we need all the ideas on the table. Which ones are going to make it through? You know, that's not for one person to say. But what we need is a more engaged and more vigorous dialogue from everybody that starts to direct traffic, if you will, in terms of what those solutions might be. Give some influence on what things we can do, because, you know, what's possible in politics today and what's possible tomorrow may be very different.
And Joanne did offer to give a quick answer.
I mean, I may be treading on Joanne's turf, but I mean, one of the questions is, what are you trying to fix? If you're trying to fix the greenhouse gas issue with limiting the number of gas-powered cars on the road, a couple of things are, you could approach it in a number of ways. One is take those cars off, but then people still need to get to KA Beach. So do we put in a more robust mass transportation system, which makes great sense? Do we mandate electric cars, which use a fraction of the fossil fuels? I mean, at some point, solar plants can fund, can charge those things. So there are a lot of different ways. Just an immediate moratorium is often the simplest step, but it's not necessarily the one that's either politically achievable or most appropriate.
Quick answer, because we now got about 90 seconds, and Rob's going to ask a one-sentence question after. Seven words.
We cannot stop something without providing an alternative, and that's why I've been working on creating a sustainable land transportation system for the island, which means we have to really develop our bus system to come more often, to come to more places, to be convenient, reliable, and then we can lure the tourists onto the bus. They're already, some of them are already riding it, and we're also developing a plan for shuttle systems in Poipu, Koloa, North Shore, and Kapawailua. And with that, we should be able to reduce the usage of visitor rented cars.
Yeah, our final question.
Okay, real quick. Direct this to Professor Steve. He's got all the stats. Impacts of causality, industrial ag, and maybe remediation also.
That's the perfect question for me because I have no biology, biological science background. But, I don't know that one. I do know this, that eating less meat has a significant impact, more so than particular farming practices. I know farming practices is something that's looked at. I haven't delved into those sections so much because that's not really my forte, but they are on the IPCC reports. But, you know, it's significant, like as in 10, 20, 30 times as much greenhouse gas emissions per meal of beef compared to, say, a grain. And there's people who advocate that. When I have a class and this issue comes up, I'll say, well, you know, you don't have to go vegan. It's just a matter of if you eat just a little bit less, every little bit helps.
Okay, Ying. So that'll conclude our questions to the panel. But we do have some time, so we're going to break up right now. One, we're hoping that – actually, sorry, before I say that, I just do want to recognize Joanne and Mason for being here, and we have Mina Morita over there, who is the chair of our PUC, previous chair. So, so we have this call to action over here, which a lot of this was them saying what KUC is going to do and what the county is doing and what's going to happen. But obviously, like, the questions were oriented – so much of it sort of comes down to us and what can we do, which we didn't touch on too much. So we're hoping that we can continue these meetings once a month. We are scheduling the next one for August 26th here. And again, Niumalu Canoe Club is here, not at Niumalu Park. So sort of as a foray into that next meeting, which will be basically entirely off of what you guys are willing to personally work for, what you think needs to be worked on. If you have ideas for population control, et cetera, this is the time to create groups and work towards these. So we have this board. There's green paper over there, those longer ones. We want you to, if you have a great idea for something tangible that you're willing to work on, put the idea on the board. If you walk up there and you see a great idea that you want to be part of, that you want to be part of a group that's working towards, write your name on that post-it note, put it under that. Make sure if you write your name on a post-it note that you've also signed in, right? That's our only way to contact you. So you got to make sure you do the sign-in sheet, then put your name on a post-it note, then put it on the board. So we want to create a meeting next week, which is just a bunch of breakout sessions on what can we do, and then we'll come together and say, you know, have we solved climate change yet? So on that note, yeah.
So you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. Jonathan has a little bit of questions.
Actually, Felicia, why don't you and I trade seats, and you can talk directly to Laurel. This is Laurel Breyer from Apollo Kauai, and please introduce yourself.
All right, Laurel, why don't you tell us your motivation and your process on putting this event together? What is the main thing you're trying to get out to the listener driving down the road now on Kauai? Listen.
We wanted the information out there to remind people of the urgency of climate change and what's occurring now and on our own island, and then to stimulate people to action, to bring people together who do want to work towards making a difference. And Kauai as an example. So what we're doing right now, tonight was mostly presentation. We had about 80 people come.
We counted close to 100.
And people are sharing their ideas of actions that they want to be involved in. And we're going to have breakout groups next time and forum groups to really come up with some concrete projects and things that we can do here that may have effects locally or statewide or nationally or even globally. So that's what we're looking at, and our next meeting is right here again at the it's called the Namalu, but it's in the Willy Willy
Canoe Hale. So is Apollo Kauai that's putting the event together, correct?
We're organizing it,
so
right.
So you've had the state, the county, the power company, and then a scientific resource. Can you tell us what Apollo Kauai is about?
Apollo Kauai formed 10 years ago, and that was under the encouragement of Mina Marita, and looking at trying to have an impact on climate change, and our goal was to encourage and advocate and educate about alternative energies. And so we're just continuing on our mission.
I want to give a shout-out also to Mason Chalk, a county council person who's here, and that I saw Mike DeHillig from the planning department came. We had a handful of people who are in policy-making positions, and so I always really appreciate it when we have – and Helen Cox from the Kauai Community College is here. So we've had a really good mix of people and people who have an impact on making these decisions. I see Chuck Blay is here, who's done really a wonderful job with geology. A good mix. Are you happy with how the event has gone?
Yes, and I think what will really be the telling tale is what happens at the next meeting, which is who's going to come and who's willing to dig in and really do the work. The date is the last Wednesday of August, which will be August 26th, and it'll be here at 6 p.m. at the Canoe Club in the Willy Willy, so it's right next to Harbor Mall there on the, jetty side, right. And we will be having monthly meetings after that, and we will have, breakout groups, too, who will be working on specific things.
So what is some contact information for you guys, for people listening right now on the airways, if they want to get in touch with Apollo Kauai?
I say show up at the next meeting. Otherwise, we do have a website, apollokauai.com.
And an email address?
An email address. It's on the website. I can't think of it right offhand. I'll give them my... I'm going to be gone in August.
Well, it's a pretty easy thing for folks to just get on Google or whatever search engine they're using and type in Apollo Kauai.
Actually, I'm sure Sherry's kind of our secretary. Sherry's right here. We need a phone number for information. Sherry's number?
822-7351.
822-7351. All right, 7351. All right, 822-7351.
And Apollo Kauai, because this is such a small community. Hey, I want to give a shout-out to Sue Kanoho from the Kauai Visitors Bureau. She's on the job, too. Yay, Sue. Pat Geegan is in here. He's also with KIUC, but he's Apollo Kauai. Zero Waste. I see John Harder's here. Many, many good contributors are here and available.
But I think this is a very successful event this evening. Almost 100 people here in the room, and you know, many people listening on the FM airwaves. This is one thing that KKCR, as a community resource, this is part of our mission, is to help elevate and amplify the impact of community organizations such as yourself, who are, you know, it's not just an entertainment or an educational mission, but this is information that you're arming people with so that they can take concrete action. So, you know, at KKCR, we don't really want our audience to be passive listeners. We want them to be engaged participants in our community. So I really want to thank you for the work that you guys have done tonight to help set this up.
Well, thank you for partnering with us and getting the word out.
So, and just one more time, if folks want to get involved, can come in. It's going to be another meeting in about a month, Wednesday, August 26th at 6 p.m., and that's the Canoe Club behind Anchor Cove in Nawili Willy. And a number to get more information is 822-7351. Thanks so much for being here tonight. Thanks for doing this, and thanks for KKCR to broadcasting this whole thing. Aloha.
Thank you. Mahalo nui loa.
Take it away, Dove.